This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's widely recognized that science has a diversity problem, as in a lack of diversity. Efforts to better prepare minority students haven't solved the problem. Now attention is turning to making educational and research institutions more welcoming and inclusive of students from all backgrounds. More on that later this hour. Also, divesting from fossil fuel interests has been a hot topic at colleges and universities, but is it a good idea for individual investors? And how do you go about doing it? Hear from an investment advisor who's literally written a book on that. We start today, though, by traveling to the bottom of the ocean. It's been 40 years since deep-sea hydrothermal vents were discovered, surprising scientists who thought the deep-sea floor was devoid of life. Today, we know that there are many different ecosystems on the seafloor, all based on microbes who make energy from chemicals rather than light. Scientists are gathering in Woods Hole this week to talk about the latest research on hydrothermal vents. A couple of them are joining me right now. Lauren Mullineaux and Stefan Sievert are both biologists at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather.
Hi, Heather.
All right, 40 years since this discovery. I mean, if nobody thought there was even life down there to find, Lauren, what were they doing down there in the first place?
The expedition was mostly geologists, and they were trying to find hydrothermal vents, but they found much, much more.
So they were looking for them in the geological sense, like a crack where maybe there's water coming out from under the seafloor.
Right.
But they didn't necessarily think they were going to find things living there.
That's right. Yeah, they didn't expect it.
How fundamentally did that discovery change our understanding of where life can exist and how life can exist in terms of, you know, making a living without sunlight?
Yeah, actually, it's less about where life could exist, but actually how it could be sustained. And you already alluded to this. Important discovery of this deep sea vents was actually that chemosynthesis was fueling these ecosystems. And so that was not expected. And that was totally unknown at that time, that the whole ecosystem could be based on chemosynthesis alone.
And 40 years later, we now know that chemosynthesis is not only the basis of deep sea hydrothermal vents, but I mean, we find it in all sorts of places, really key to a lot of different ecosystems. Can you give us some examples?
Right, that's correct. And so, yeah, shortly after the discovery of deep sea vents, cold seeps were discovered, which also are fueled by chemosynthetic processes.
And so a cold seep versus a hydrothermal vent. I mean, what's the difference there to the average observer looking at, you know, video from deep sea robots and stuff? How different do they look?
That's a good question. I mean, I think cold seep, as the name implies, actually, there's not warm water coming out, actually, but cold water. But the water coming out still contains reduced chemicals that are driving these ecosystems. So that's where the similarity is between cold seeps and warm vents or hot vents, actually.
Okay, Lauren, it's not just the microbes that are in these ecosystems. I mean, we've been calling them ecosystems. So it's not just a bunch of microbes that are hanging out at hydrothermal vents or cold seeps. There's these really complex, diverse ecosystems and tons of animals as well.
That's right.
I mean, how just mind-blowing was that the first time that you realized that it's not just microbes, it's really complex?
Well, you know, the footage of the deep-sea images from that discovery cruise are really very striking because you see snapshots. They were towing a camera that was taking pictures, and you see rocks, and then you see these giant clams that are as much as 12 inches long, and that was just astonishing.
Wow. So the animals that live there, are they just slightly modified cousins? I mean, the clams you're talking about, they pretty much look like a clam. They just eat these different bacteria instead of what they eat, you know, in shallow water around Cape Cod, or are these really distinctly different, unique animals that live in some of these ecosystems?
Some of them are recognizable. So, yes, the clams look like just giant cousins of the clams you might find on the seashores here. Others of them are really very, very different. And so one of the most iconic species at deep-sea hydrothermal vents is the giant tube worm, Riftia.
Right, and big white tubes with,
yes,
that look like red lips almost on the tip of them.
Exactly, and those can get up to as much as 3 meters long. And they're really famous because they have no mouth and no gut.
So how do they survive?
Right. So they depend on the microbes. And that reddish plume is actually a gas transport organ. It brings in the hydrogen sulfide that the microbes need, and it brings it down into the main part of the body, which is really most of the biomass of a tube worm is bacteria.
Well, and that gets it at one of the other kind of unusual things about these ecosystems is that a lot of the animals form these really close relationships with the microbes. It's maybe not the way we think of a lot of ecosystems where it's like, okay, there's, you know, there's bacteria in the soil and there's plants growing and there are animals who come along and graze and eat them or whatever and find their food. A lot of these animals are like gardeners and growing microbes on their backs or in their guts. And do we have any idea why they form such tight relationships with some of these microbes?
Yeah, so, you know, those are the symbiotic relationships, and I don't, that's not my field. I'm going to pass this one over to Stefan.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. I mean, I think it's, you know, it allows these animals, of course, to tap into an energy source and food source that otherwise would not be available for them. And how exactly these, you know, these symbioses evolved is still subject to investigations, but really, yeah, these animals have found a way to tap into that and to make a living, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm just speculating here, but, you know, you're talking about lard and you look at the footage and it's rocks, 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 and then it's a hydrothermal vent. I mean, there's nothing else around. You don't want to lose track of your only possible food source for however far it is to the next hydrothermal vent, you know. So is it maybe just about a scarcity kind of issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't know exactly how these evolved, but I think at the time, probably microbes were living there and animals close by. And then over time, you know, they forged these kind of relationships that was to the benefit of both of them. The microbes have a benefit too, because the host really supplies them with chemicals that otherwise might be more dilute, for example, and they're really concentrated by the host, you know, to make them available to the bacteria.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Stefan Sievert and Lauren Mullineau of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about deep sea hydrothermal vents. It's been 40 years since these bizarre and beautiful, intriguing ecosystems were discovered. Lauren, one of the, you know, big questions when you've got these little islands of ecosystems, essentially these hydrothermal vents or cold seeps that are sprinkled around with a lot of dark, barren ocean in between them, is how do they actually get there? And how do they, you know, maybe spread from one to the next? I mean, is every hydrothermal vent, is it a different, slightly different species because they've evolved on their own, or are they somehow moving around to these different ecosystems?
Right. So, you know, most of these species can live only at vents, and most of them can't walk very far. So they're sessile as adults, the clams, the tube worms, but they do have a mobile life history stage. They have a planktonic larva that can get up into the water column and can drift in the currents.
So they're just kind of sending their babies out into the ocean and good luck, go find another one.
Yeah, hoping for the best.
How fragile and vulnerable does that make these ecosystems to something like human impacts? I mean, obviously, it seems like they're pretty remote. They're down at the bottom of the ocean. You'd have to really look to go find one. But if one, I mean, are there threats to them from human activities?
Yeah, so that is that question taps into a big controversy because the species living at vents have to be able to survive in patchy habitats. And they also have to be able to survive in habitats that get disturbed every once in a while, because essentially a deep sea hydrothermal vent is on top of an active volcano, and occasionally the volcano erupts. So there are some people who think that these communities are adapted to disturbance, and so any additional disturbance that might occur won't have a big impact on them. And one of the potential disturbances that could be added at this time is deep sea mining.
Which sounds completely crazy. I mean, I know we already do some pretty amazing things in the name of mining in terms of how deep we can dig into the ocean, but resorting to going to the bottom of the ocean, thousands of feet underwater, and then trying to mine something, what is it that we would get from down there that we couldn't get any other way?
Yeah, so it's precious metals, gold, silver, copper, manganese, those sorts of things. And you're right, it seems crazy, but when the balance of the economics makes it so that you can get more money by bringing those metals up from the deep sea floor than it costs to go down there to get them, then the process becomes attractive.
On the flip side of, you know, what we might do to hydrothermal vents, there's what hydrothermal vents might do for us besides just stimulating our curiosity and looking cool. I mean, if you've got these interesting microbes who are making a living off of chemicals in kind of an unusual metabolic way, that's often a place we could look to find other unusual chemicals that might have all sorts of uses. Pharmaceuticals is one I'm thinking of, but you know, these are the kind of places we might go to look for potentially useful chemicals, right?
That's correct. And I think, you know, the vents are a prime example of maybe discovering these. First of all, like you pointed out, it's a very unusual place, unusual life forms. But also it's a place where you have high diversity, high density of organisms and hyperactivity, similar to tropical rainforest, for example. And so these kind of, you know, microbe-animal associations and also microbe interactions make it feasible that the probably are a lot of bioactive compounds that are used by these organisms to cope with each other, you know, to interact. And so that's certainly a potential to tap into. And some of it already is happening, but it's far from being realized at this point. But there have been already some compounds being identified, and there's a promising future. But again, if you start, you know, thinking about this, there's also potential impact, you know, by you know, maybe going there and extracting these kind of compounds from these vent systems.
So. Right, we might want to figure out what the compounds are and if there's a way that we can make them synthetically, not just going down and harvesting
right, that would be
hydrothermal
ideal.
Vent worms to extract it.
Exactly, yeah, right.
You know, the use of various DNA technologies over the past few decades has really revolutionized most fields of biology, especially when you're talking about the diversity of the microbes that are there and the animals that are there as well. How much has that kind of technology given us an insight into deep sea hydrothermal vents?
I mean, that has played a really big role. I mean, starting with the early 90s, there was this push, you know, using molecular techniques to look at biomarkers like 16S ribosomal RNA, which showed us that there's much larger diversity than we initially thought there would be. But now with the new sequencing technology, next generation sequencing, we can really sequence the metagenome, so the whole genomic content of the microbial community, for example.
So not just one species genome, but just kind of go down and grab, this is the microbial ecosystem, and you can sequence all of that.
Right, exactly. And
that's
really
cool.
Allows us to then look into the functions that are encoded in these genomes and see, you know, what's really, you know, what kind of pathways do these organisms have, and how do they interact, for example, and what are the adaptations of these organisms to this ecosystem. Yeah,
there's been a big push in the past few years, and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is a big part of this, to create kind of distributed automated systems that just kind of help us keep an eye on the ocean all the time, ocean observing systems. Are hydrothermal vents part of that? Could we be kind of watching these hydrothermal vents on a more regular basis instead of, you know, the once or twice a year that a cruise goes out and puts a robot down there? And if we did, what do you think we might learn about them?
Yes, so we're already doing that. And there is an observatory system on the Juan de Fuca Ridge. They placed a set of cameras and other sensors there specifically because they thought it was a dynamic site and they wanted to see what happened over time there, both in the chemistry and the geology of the site and in the response of the biological communities.
So we're already keeping an eye on these.
We are. We're just waiting for a big eruption in that site and hoping that it doesn't pave the camera over.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, let me know if that happens. We will want to see that footage. That is Lauren Mullineau of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, also Stefan Sievert, giving us the latest on hydrothermal vent research. Thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Up next, how to divest from fossil fuels and why one investment advisor says you might want to consider doing that. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.